For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, where students can conduct NASA research, produce an original play, or join an in-house marketing agency as early as their freshman year. More information is available at carthage.edu. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, you're going to be meeting one of the most spectacularly talented and successful musicians ever to come from Racine, trumpeter Tim Burke, a proud graduate of Case High School and the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Tim Burke for a time played with the Stan Kenton Orchestra and with Woody Herman's Thundering Herd, before settling down in Chicago and becoming one of Chicago's busiest and most successful freelance trumpeters. Tim Burke, in addition to all kinds of side work, has also played in the pit in a wide array of wonderful Broadway musical productions in Chicago, including the full Chicago run of Wicked, as well as in the world premiere productions of Kinky Boots, The Addams Family, The Cher Show, and Tootsie, and he is about to embark on a nationwide tour with the show Frozen. Tim Burke is coming back to Racine to play a concert this Sunday night, 7:30 p.m., with the Racine Concert Band under the direction of Mark Eichner. That concert will be taking place in the Racine Zoo Amphitheater. And by the way, I've had the pleasure of speaking several times on the morning show with Tim Burke's talented brother, Mick Burke, a well-known journalist here in southeastern Wisconsin. I began my conversation with Tim Burke by asking him to describe where his love affair with the trumpet began.
My mom is the one that basically sort of steered me towards trumpet back around fourth, fifth grade when it was time to pick a musical instrument. She used to always play, we played a lot of Tijuana Brass around the house. She played a lot of Al Hurt, and she was always kind of poking me, say, "Hey, Tim, listen to that trumpet, listen to that trumpet." And I did listen to the trumpet, and I loved the sound of it. So when fifth grade, when it was time to pick an instrument, I gravitated towards trumpet or cornet at that time. And then I was incredibly fortunate to get with Johnny Hemkes when I was only in sixth grade. And that was the sort of the defining moment in my growth as a musician, because Johnny Hemkes, as most of the people that are anywhere near my age know in Racine and Kenosha, they know that he was the guru of brass teaching in the area. Johnny was a wonderful man, a fantastic teacher, and kind of a second father figure to all of his students, his thousands and thousands of students. Mm. So I was so fortunate to get with Johnny at an early age. And, of course, I stayed with him all the way through high school. And it didn't take me too many years to realize that not only I was fortunate enough to have some talent, but also that I just loved playing. And I didn't mind practicing, which, you know, that's not always the case with 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th graders. So it kind of laid out the path for me.
Great. So when you first picked up a trumpet and blew into it, what do you remember about those initial efforts? Because it's one thing to listen to a trumpet on a record and think, that's a great, great sound. That sounds like fun. It's another thing to pick up the trumpet and blow into it yourself and try to make that sound. What were your first efforts like?
Boy, you know, I don't know the very, very first efforts, but I do know that it didn't take me too long before I started getting a fairly decent sound, and then I was able to, you know, play some of the basic tunes that we all start with, you know, the Mary Had a Little Lamb and those kind of things. And as soon as you're able to play any kind of a melody at an early age, you feel fairly accomplished. And I remember, yeah, thankfully, some of that Tijuana Brass stuff was, some of it was pretty complex, but some of it was fairly simple, too. So it wasn't too terribly long before I was able to play some of the easier Tijuana Brass tunes. And that really, that's like a big accomplishment when you're in sixth or seventh grade. And I was grateful that I was able to kind of try to play along with some of that stuff.
Mm. You've already talked a little bit about Johnny Hemkes, who, of course, is a really, really big name for many people here in southeastern Wisconsin. They know the name well. Tell us more about what he was like as a teacher. I mean, what was a typical lesson like, and what were the things that stood out in terms of him being a really fine teacher and the right teacher for you?
Good question. Thank you. Johnny was endless patience, number one, at least with me he was. I think Johnny knew with each individual student who he had to push their buttons to really get them to work hard and who was already very, very hard on them, the students that were already hard on themselves. And I was one that was always pretty hard on myself, so I remember at a very early age Johnny telling me not to be so hard on myself. He said, there's going to be enough people out there during your life that are going to criticize you or, not have positive approaches to what you're doing. He says, don't be so hard on yourself. So he was kind of a psychiatrist in that regard. He knew which students he had to threaten with his waiting list, which was about an arm, like, you know, his waiting list stretched for feet, many feet. Mm-hmm. He always had hundreds of names on his waiting list. So he knew which students he had to give a little threat to and which ones to just kind of and to prop them up a little bit. And, you know, he was just an amazing man in that regard. But in terms of the basics of brass playing, Johnny just had it down cold. You know, I remember from the very, very first lesson talking about diaphragm breathing and the things that we've come to learn many, many years later. This is the stuff that a lot of kids don't get taught at a very early age. And Johnny really focused on all the basics of brass playing, but then also playing a musical singing style. He really liked to focus, you know, to tell you to try to sing through the horn. And you know, that's, I think, ultimately instrumentalists try to sound like great vocalists. You know, if I play a melody, I try to think of the way somebody like Barbara Streisand or let's just say Harry Connick or somebody like that, try to play through the horn the way the great vocalists would interpret a melody.
Hmm. You've already mentioned that it was your mom's Tijuana Brass records that sort of initially ignited your interest in the trumpet, and so obviously right off the bat, that's what you were hearing and not necessarily the Haydn trumpet concerto in E-flat major. I assume that there was a fair amount of classical grounding and classical rep in at least some of your early study. At what point did you have to start kind of making conscious choices to embrace a particular kind of rep, a particular kind of playing, versus kind of doing it all? I mean, at some point, did it start to become evident that you were going to be a particular kind of trumpet player and specializing in a certain kind of playing?
That's another great question because, luckily, again, getting back to Johnny taught us all to play very well-rounded styles. We always had to be involved in the solo and ensemble contest, and that usually meant playing something just to what you were alluding to, like the Haydn trumpet concerto or the Hummel or something like that along those lines. And Johnny pretty much had us all playing the type of equipment on our horn that could get a really well-rounded sound. So if you wanted to go, if you wanted to dive into the classical world, you'd already had a good big sound because he had us on a fairly big mouthpiece. Mouthpiece is one of those components that will drastically change the sound that you get. And all the way through high school, he had us playing on a Bach 1.5C, which is a big mouthpiece. And to his credit, he said, hey, this doesn't have to limit you in terms of playing in the upper register. And he was right. It didn't limit us. So I think it was in high school when I first started hearing the big bands, when I was fortunate enough to hear Buddy Rich and then Maynard Ferguson, I started realizing that that's what I really, really wanted to do was to get with some of those big bands and hopefully tour the world doing that. And it was shortly after high school that I began to gear my equipment a little bit more towards a brighter, more commercial sound. And it really is difficult to do all facets incredibly well. I mean, as a freelance player, you have to be able to kind of, as I quote-unquote call it, fake it, you know, being a what we would call a legit guy. You know, you get hired to play a piccolo trumpet on at a wedding ceremony. You better sound at least a little bit like somebody from the Chicago Symphony or, you know, or somebody that can at least, like I say, fake it and sound fairly good. That's kind of a tongue-in-cheek, you know, term, because we're not really faking it. You're just trying to play with a beautiful sound. So anyway, but it is around the time of graduating from high school, going into college, that you really had to begin to start sort of fine-tune your sound towards the particular idiom that you're going to go into. And for me, that was when I went to Berklee College of Music, and then I started getting into brighter, more brilliant sounds, because I knew by that time I wanted to be a lead trumpet player, and I wanted to be able to ride over the top of the orchestra, or the big band, as it were, and cut through and, you know, get the sound that was going to be the correct sound.
Hmm. Can you just describe for a moment your experience in Case High School and also UW Parkside before you got to Berklee College of Music, and what kind of a foundation you were given in terms of your trumpet experience there?
Sure. Well, you know, at Case we had Fred Brewer was our band director. Fred was a great guy. He was always encouraging us to meet as an ensemble. We didn't have jazz band as a regular class that we could just go to every day, but he encouraged us to meet, you know, before school, after school, to, you know, to have a really good jazz band. And by the time I was just about a senior in high school at Case, I think it was Johnny that encouraged me. I think at that time I met Bob Thomason, who was the jazz ensemble director out at Parkside. And Bob was also a trumpet player. And Johnny said, you know, sent me to meet him to play for him. And Johnny was encouraging me to go to Parkside for a year or two to get all my gen eds out of the way. And I went and met with Bob and played for him. And lo and behold, he ended up asking me to play in the Parkside Jazz Ensemble my senior year in high school. So that year, I actually spent most of my time at Parkside and not as much time over at Case, because I already had enough high school credits to graduate. So I would still go to Case a couple days a week to take one or two classes and play in the ensemble there. But I was also taking 16 credits at Parkside and playing in the jazz ensemble. And that turned out to be really valuable experience for me, because I was kind of the kid amongst all these veteran college jazz players. And it was a really great experience for me. I was really fortunate to be immersed in this group of, I mean, Bob Thomason had a really nice jazz ensemble there, and I was lucky enough to be immersed into that situation at a fairly young age.
Fantastic. At that point in time, did you have any serious episodes in which you kind of fell out of love with the trumpet, or fell out of love with serious, relentless music making, where you felt like were tempted in any way to put the trumpet away and take up basket weaving or basketball or whatever instead, or not really? I mean, did this really take hold of you and never release its grip?
It pretty much took hold of me and never released its grip. And I'll tell you, Greg, I was so fortunate to have the parents that I had. My dad, who was Dr. Donald Burke in Racine, was one of the three surgeons in town. And my dad and my mom both supported me just absolutely 100%. I think they saw at a fairly young age that I was having some success. I was always getting all the, you know, I was getting the superior ratings at Solon and Samba contest, and tried out for the Wisconsin Honors Orchestra, and I made that, and, you know, I was playing first chair there and that kind of thing. So they saw that I was having some success, and they knew that was my passion, and they're the ones that took me to see Buddy Rich back in, I think I was, I said high school before, but I actually think it was maybe ninth grade or so, and that's when I really just flipped over the sound of big band. And so my parents were so cool. I still remember the very short, succinct conversation I had with my dad when he was asking me about college. You know, where do I want to go? Well, there really were only two choices back in that day. If you wanted to become a big band trumpet player, and you knew that's what I wanted, it was either North Texas or it was Berkeley in Boston. And he asked me which one I wanted to go to, and I said Berkeley, because I had just read a little promo brochure on it, talking about how Buddy Rich picked up his players from Berkeley, and I thought, well, this is where I got to go. And I told my dad, and he said, okay, get the application. That was the end of the conversation. I got the application, gave it to him, and it was a done deal. You know, I got the appropriate letters of recommendation from Johnny and various people, sent it in, and then moved to Boston to start something completely different.
The rest is history. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with trumpeter Tim Burke, originally from Racine, born and raised, and someone who has gone on to tremendous success. Tim Burke is returning to Racine to appear as guest soloist with the Racine Concert Band on Sunday evening, July 11th, for one of their concerts in the Racine Zoo Amphitheater, a very, very special occasion that no one should miss. Tim Burke, what was it like to go from the friendly confines of Racine all the way to Boston? I mean, to be in a completely new place amidst strangers. Was that kind of a wrenching, difficult experience for you, or by and large, was it a positive transition and something that was kind of a joyous experience from day one?
Well, again, another good question. You know, it was bittersweet, of course, living the wonderful situation that I had with Bob Thomas and the Parkside folks and my folks and Johnny, but it was also really, really exciting because I couldn't wait to get there, and I couldn't wait to try to make myself a better trumpet player, number one, but also hopefully to make myself known amongst the, you know, at the school so that I could, you know, rise to the top with, and, you know, hopefully get that gig on the road. So, It was both. It was really exciting, and it was a bit intimidating, truthfully, because when I got there, I found out there was somewhere around, I think, 150 to 200 trumpet players there, and wow. I still remember going to the audition process, which was kind of basic, and I thought, you know, how am I going to, there's so darn many players here, how am I going to, you know, excel amongst this group? But it didn't take too terribly long before I started getting known as one of the lead players at the school that could read well and play. And again, thanks to the wonderful background that I had with Johnny, I knew how to read well. And a lot of players in college didn't. That was one thing that they had to learn to do, become really good readers and good phrasing and, you know, how to set, how to stand behind a big band and be the leader as a lead trumpet player really is. You know, there's the lead trumpet player is the one that sets the style for the big band, and between him and the drummer and the bass player, basically that's the rhythm of the band right there. The lead trumpet player sets the swing, the style, and the feel along with the drummer and the bass player. And everybody else's, their job really is to listen and to support. And if you have a great lead trumpet player, the band should be pretty swinging.
So how long were you at Berklee College of Music? My understanding is you left Berklee to join the Stan Kenton Orchestra. So
that's right.
Did you leave it before you had a piece of paper on the wall, as they say?
Yes, exactly. I did. I had done 3 years there. And I had not. I was getting close to graduating, but I didn't quite get there. And then I was fortunate enough to get this phone call out of nowhere. Well, it seemed like out of nowhere, and yet in hindsight, I can sort of trace it back to how it happened. And if you're interested, I'll tell you how that sort of happened.
Sure.
By my third year at Berklee, I was then playing lead in Herb Pomeroy's band. It was also known as the quote-unquote the recording band, because once a week we would meet in the studio and record projects of the top students at the school. And so the recording band was considered, that was as high as you could go. It was like the equivalent of North Texas playing in the 1 o'clock lab band, which is, you know, famous throughout the country. Everyone knows the North Texas 1 o'clock lab band. And Berklee's version of that was the recording band. So I was playing lead trumpet in it at that time by my third year. And one day we were rehearsing, and there's a trombone player standing listening to the band. And Herb turned around and said hello to him. Said, "Hey, Roger, how you doing, man?" Well, Roger was in town with Maynard Ferguson. They were playing that night in Boston somewhere. And Roger, having gone to Berklee, came over to say hello to Herb. And Herb said, "Hey, our lead trombone player is sick today. Why don't you grab your horn and sit in with us?" So Roger took his horn out of his case, sat down, and played the rehearsal with us. And 2 hours later, an hour later at the end of the rehearsal, he turned around to me and said, "Hey, man, you sound great. Can I get your phone number?" And I gave it to him. And about 6 months later, he was now on Stan Kenton's orchestra, which was kind of common back in those days for guys to, after touring with one band, maybe a year or two later, get with one of the other touring bands. Anyway, now he was with Stan Kenton, and they needed a trumpet player. And he basically told the manager, "Hey, I know this kid at Berklee. His name is Tim Burke, and why don't we give him a try?" And that's, you know, a minute later, I'm getting the phone call and deciding to leave school to do what I had always wanted to do.
Wow. And from the way you have framed that, I am assuming that that was not a terribly difficult choice for you to make. Or was it a more difficult choice than we might assume? Or
no.
Okay.
No, it was exactly what. By that time, some of the other members of the recording band were already getting asked to go on the road too. A few of them had, I think, two or three players had recently gone out with the Dorsey Band, which was one of the quote-unquote ghost bands because, you know, obviously Tommy Dorsey was no longer alive, but it was still a real swinging, great touring band. And a couple guys had left to go on that band. And then I was asked to go with Stan. I remember going to Herb Pomeroy and telling him about the chance, and he said he totally encouraged me to take it. And, of course, he loved that orchestra, and I think he called him, Stan Kenton, I think he said, "Ah, yes, the Stone Canyon Orchestra." and, you know, just using his usual tongue-in-cheek humor, but he had totally encouraged me to take the gig. And as it turned out, Stan was not very healthy towards the end of during this time. That's a long story in itself, which I won't get too much into why he was not so healthy. But after 4 months of being on that band, Stan had to fold the band, and because of ill health, and you know, when he folded the band, he basically told everybody, "Okay, in 6 months or a year, whenever I'm healthy, we're going to get back out on the road again. And I'll be calling each one of you guys." Well, as fate would have it, about 2 or 3 weeks later, I got a call to play the split lead chair on Woody's band. And, of course, that was a no-brainer for me because Woody's band was really, I had heard them as a senior in high school. I'd heard them at Interlochen Music School, which was a summer camp that I was lucky enough to attend. And I was just absolutely knocked out by that band. And that was a very, very simple decision to make to go with that band. And very nerve-wracking. I got told on a Tuesday, and I had just, after Stan had folded the band, I had just gone back to Boston. I was going to do my final semester, get that piece of paper to put on the wall as you as you described. And I got the call, and so I said yes, and I went back down to the bursar's office at Berkeley, got the tuition check back, packed up my belongings, drove all the way back to Wisconsin, and then flew to New York to meet the band the next day. I had about 2 or 3 days notice to join the band and then play with the band that night, which was a totally nerve-wracking experience because I hadn't seen the book, and, you know, that's why you're expected to be a good sight reader. But it all worked out well. The guys in the band were very welcoming, wonderful guys, and it turned out to be the experience of a lifetime for me. Such a swinging, terrific band with really wonderful players, and just the time of my life, actually. Mm. Yeah, I stayed on the band from when I was 22 to 25 and just had an absolute ball.
We're talking, of course, about Woody Herman's Thundering Herd. And, I mean, this is really an interesting story because, of course, what you're describing is somebody who decides to leave school to join an orchestra, the Stan Kenton Orchestra, which folds 4 months later. And so, I mean, in that moment, it might have felt like something of a catastrophe. But then this other opportunity comes along that is every bit as exciting, maybe even more exciting for you, and off you go. Can you just say a quick word about the difference, if any, between the Stan Kenton Orchestra and Woody Herman's Thundering Herd? I mean, were they essentially just two different shirts on the same rack, or are there ways in which those two groups really were different or functioned differently, from your point of view at least?
Yeah, no, that's another really good question, because really they were completely different in a lot of ways. And yet, to the casual viewer who's just walking by and hearing the two bands, they're both swinging, killing big bands, but completely different. And both of them reflected the style of their leader. And Stan was a little bit more stoic. And, of course, he was a piano player. So a lot of the tunes started out with a piano solo and sort of obbligato piano solo, and then would go into this more classical or neophonic type sound that he had developed through the years. He had five trumpets all standing in a row at the back of the stage, which was set up in a semicircle. So right from the outset, it's different because the saxes are along one side, the trumpets are straight ahead when you're looking at the band, and the trombones are on the other side. So instead of the stacked formation that all the other bands had, the orchestra was set up in a semicircle, and the drums and percussion, which was a huge part of his music, was right in the middle. And as Stan played through the years, did a lot of Latin-style music, and so he had an incredible conga player whose name back then, Ramon Lopez, had been on the band for, I don't know, 30-some years. Back when I was touring with, maybe not 30, maybe I'm exaggerating because I was a young kid and I wasn't sure, but Ramon had been on the band forever. His hands were like elephant skin. He could just beat the heck out of those conga drums and get this incredible sound. So basically each band always reflects the style of the orchestrators that are within the band. And Stan had developed a bunch of wonderful orchestrators that usually played with his band at some time or another. And they wrote for the style of that band, which is completely different than Woody. Woody's band, way back in the 40s, was originally known as the band that plays the blues. And then after a while, then it became the bebop band. And then finally around in the 50s, it became the Thundering Herd. And it was much more, it was a different feel completely. Now, Woody being a clarinet player and a blues clarinet player, also a singer. Woody had a beautiful voice and used to sing two or three tunes every single night. So each band always reflected the leader that it had. And in that way, they were completely different. Just like Maynard's band, you know, he had just a bunch of wailing, screaming trumpet maniacs behind him, because that's what he did. And all those arrangements were to feature the stratospheric, you know, trumpets that that the way he played and the way that the guys that got in his band played. And then Buddy Rich, you know, the other big band that was out there at that time, obviously was just an incredible band, super, super tight, and it reflected the way that he played. Buddy Rich was such a virtuosic drummer. I mean, maybe, probably the greatest drummer that will ever live. I think even the great drummers today would tell you that about Buddy. Hmm. You know, he just had such incredible technique that they just... you know, their jaws just would fall over when they would fall open, rather, when they would see him play his big drum solo, which he did at the end of every single night. So it was really interesting, because each band really reflected the take charge or the loose approach or whatever the approach of the leader was. And Woody was somewhere in the middle. Woody wasn't quite as much of a taskmaster as Buddy was, and there are legendary stories about Buddy being such a taskmaster. Stan was a little bit more aloof, but Woody was somewhere in the middle. You know, when he wanted something a certain way, he could be a real general. But most of the time, 90% of the time, he just kind of let the band do what it wanted until it was time for him to step in and take charge.
Hmm. We're speaking with trumpeter Tim Burke about his wide-ranging career, which included stints with the Stan Kenton Orchestra, the Woody Herman's Thundering Herd, and a very, very busy and wonderful career centered in Chicago, playing for a plethora of Broadway shows, which we'll talk about in just a moment. We're talking with Tim Burke today because of his upcoming performance with the Racine Concert Band on Sunday evening, July 11th, when he will appear with that group under the direction of Mark Eichner in the Racine Zoo Amphitheater. So if I understand correctly, you had a very, very busy few years with the Woody Herman group, the Thundering Herd, playing at music festivals all over the world, President Reagan's inauguration, one of them, and so on. And then at some point you decided to settle in Chicago and go, in a sense, kind of another direction, as I think maybe largely as a freelancer right off the bat. Can you tell us about that decision? I mean, was there any way in which that was kind of imposed on you, or was that something you freely chose, and for what reason?
It was a free choice to leave the band. It was a tough one, because I was still having the time of my life. But I think somewhere in the back of my head, I knew that I had to get on with the rest of my life. I wasn't going to be a lifer, as we would call it, the guys that stayed on the band for 20, 30, 40 years. I wasn't going to do that because I came from a big family, six kids, and I knew that I wanted to have a family. And in the United States, there were really only three choices that made sense. It was either L.A., New York, or Chicago. And being a Midwestern guy and having the good fortune to spend time in all three locales through our travels, I knew that I wanted to settle in the Midwest, because, you know, the stereotype of New York is that it's, you know, fast-paced and uptight, and, you know, I loved visiting New York, but I also knew that I didn't want to live there, and L.A. was just kind of the opposite of that, and I liked the groundedness of the Midwest. And so it was a real easy choice to pick Chicago. And I had some friends that were as soon as I got off the road, they were starting to call me to get some work. And so I ended up buying a condo in 84 in Chicago. And I got to backtrack a little bit. By 84, I did buy my place, but by 82, I had, about a year after getting off of Woody's band, I did my first Broadway tour, and that was A Chorus Line. And it was such a blast. And I'd always liked playing show music, even going back into, all the way back to sixth grade and seventh grade. I always liked doing the shows every year, the once-a-year show that the junior highs and the high schools would do. And I love sitting in the pit and playing, you know, doing that kind of thing, playing the same show over and over again. It didn't bother me. And I was fortunate enough to get hired to play Great America while I was going to school in Boston. I would come back and play at the Great American Music Hall at Six Flags at Marriott's Great America, and we did four shows a day of that, and I like that. I like the repetitiveness of it. I like trying to play it, the show perfectly all the time, and I like the vibe and being with a small group of guys, maybe, you know, 10 to 15 to 20 musicians, and feeling the energy come off the stage because you're sitting in the pit and you're looking right up at the performers. There's something really cool about that. Anyway, so I did my first tour of A Chorus Line in 82, and as it turned out, that turned out to be one of many shows during the 80s. I would basically go out on tour, save a bunch of money, come back into Chicago, and you really try to get ensconced into the freelance scene, which does take some time, no matter who you are and whatever level that you're playing. It's going to take some time to break into a major size city. So a lot of times for the most part during the 80s, I would go out on the road, save a bunch of money, come back, kind of go through it, and then eventually I started getting hired at Marriott's Lincolnshire Theater, that nice little theater in the round. And by the late 80s, I was their sort of resident reed trumpet player, which I did for quite a few years. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's kind of, I knew that I was going to have a family, that I wanted to have a family. And in 87, I met the love of my life. And actually, shortly after I met her, I went out on Dreamgirls. And while I was out on Dreamgirls, I kept on flying Lucy, my wife, out to visit me. And eventually, we decided we were going to get married. And I jumped off the tour so that I could get married. Mm-hmm. And then we were starting to set up our life there and our family.
You've played for a plethora of shows. I mean, a really, really long list. I could probably fill the rest of our time just listing them all. My question to you is, how different is the pleasure of playing one show versus another in terms of what you have to do? I mean, when we look at, for instance, A Chorus Line, Evita, Dreamgirls, Starlight Express, Into the Woods, Frozen, Wicked, Kinky Boots, Addams Family, Tootsie, and so on. I suspect that maybe some of those shows are more fun than others, in the same way that playing lead trumpet for such and such a symphony is more fun than this symphony because the composer's just given you more to do or more interesting things to do. Or by and large, is that not what we're talking about with these major Broadway shows? Are they all really cool to play, and do they all give you comparable pleasure as a musician?
Again, another good question. Certainly some shows are more fun than others. The ones that are heavily, that lean on the brass heavily, are certainly more fun for me to play. And shows like Aladdin, very big brassy show. Shows like Dreamgirls, Chorus Line was a really good brass show. Some are without a doubt more fun than others. And the challenge is to still sound great on every show, whether you're in love with it or not. Sometimes you have to play that show maybe 10 weeks, so that's 8 times a week. So you have to play 80 performances of that show. And you better sound like you love it when you're playing it, because nobody really cares whether you do or don't like the show. The challenge is to sound great on every show that you're playing, on every performance. And I tell students that nobody cares if your chops are not feeling good that day. You know, you better sound like your chops are feeling good. And even if you're a little bit sick or a little under the weather, whatever the deal is, you better sound like you're feeling great. Mm. Because hopefully and you know this, Greg, as a performer, sometimes you feel like $1 million and you go in and you just know you're going to have a great show and everything. Hopefully the difference between those shows and the ones where you don't feel so good, hopefully that's not that noticeable to the audience. You know, that's you want to have such a level of consistency that they don't really know whether you're feeling great or whether you're feeling lousy. You're still able to perform at a high level and be very consistent.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
I appreciate the fact that you've played for for at least four world premieres for Kinky Boots, Adam's Family, The Cher Show, and Tootsie. And I should think that's a kind of an especially exciting experience to be on the ground floor. Is it also kind of a harrowing thing in which a score is changing as opening night approaches? It's not a done deal set in stone.
Absolutely. You know, that, again, and that's, it's actually a lot more than four. We did also Escape from Margaritaville, the Jimmy Buffett show, and he was around playing Margaritaville with us on the closing night of that several times. And we did Adam's Family. So we did a lot of that. And yes, to your question, Kathy's Harling, absolutely, especially that first day when you've got the composer, the orchestrator, the music supervisor, the choreographer, producer, and everybody from New York all in that same room, and everybody is dying for a hit. And a lot of times it has been 5 to 10 years or 12 or 13 years in the making to get to that point where they're actually sitting and listening to the music for the first time with an actual orchestra. They, up until that point, they've been doing little workshops with a cut-down version, maybe a rhythm section. You know, the first couple of years is probably just with a pianist trying to get the tunes straight the way that they want them to be. And then eventually they raise the backing, they raise enough money that they can hire somebody to do the full orchestrations. And this is the first time that they're hearing those orchestrations for real. And it can be an incredibly harrowing and stressful situation. It can also be incredibly powerful and moving. I have seen many times the orchestrator or the composer hearing this, you know, this beautiful group of maybe 20 musicians playing these things for the first time and watching them with tears streaming down their face as they're hearing this finally come to fruition after a long, long process to get to that point. And then, yeah, there's a lot of changes that go on. You know, sometimes you come back for the second day of rehearsal and one of the numbers you played before, cut, gone. We don't like that number. Now that we're hearing it, that one's gone from the show, and this is going to replace it. Somebody's been up all night scratching something out, and, you know, we're going to use this as a filler until we get the actual tune that's going to replace this one. And it can be very stressful. I mean, it is very stressful, truthfully, but it's also kind of that adrenaline rush that we all sort of thrive on, too.
Absolutely. I want to be sure to take a couple of minutes to talk with, I wish we had longer to talk about the work that you also do in Chicago or have done quite a lot of contracting orchestras, that is hiring right. The musicians who play in an orchestra. I happen to know someone else from Racine, a young man by the name of Justin Smith, who grew up in Racine, now lives in New York City and has played in some major shows out there as a violinist and has also done some of that same work of contracting musicians for various orchestras. And I find that to be so interesting. When you are putting an orchestra together, what kind of musicians are you looking for? I should think you're looking for musicians comparable to yourself, but what does it take to be the kind of musician who is going to fill out the obligations and responsibilities of this kind of work most effectively?
Well, you know, I kind of fell into contracting. I really wasn't looking for it at the time that it happened. In the mid-90s, I was fortunate enough to get hired to play with this show called Music of the Night. And I met a wonderful gentleman named Sam Lucia who hired me. And I'll never forget when he called me for the first time in the mid-90s. And I'd never heard his name before, but we ended up having a 45-minute conversation where he really wanted to get to know me. He said he had been calling around Chicago, looking for a trumpet player to do this tour that he had coming up, and I was recommended by a few people. And anyway, he took 45 minutes getting to know me, and I when I finally got off the phone, I told my wife, I said, wow, this was amazing. This guy just, he had so many interesting questions. He was such a great guy, such a wonderful, I had such a fantastic conversation with him. Anyway, long story short, he hired me for the tour. And I got to know him very well. And when that tour folded a couple of years later, he helped set me up as the contractor working for Broadway in Chicago. And he helped me through the initial process, because it can be difficult, as you alluded to. You have to get the right players and, you know, people that have the right mindset. Maybe not always the greatest player that you know, but somebody that has the right mindset for playing 8 shows a week. Some of the people that are incredibly creative don't have the right mindset for that. They're world-class improvisers, but maybe they don't have the right mindset to play 8 shows a week and try to do it perfectly each time. It began a very long time that I did it, 22 years. And because contracting is also a management level position, it comes with its own headaches, you know, having to prepare budgets every week for the entire orchestra. Who subbed out? Who was their sub? Make sure to pay this guy for 6 shows and his sub for 2 shows, and, you know, make sure the conductor is happy with the subs and all the things that come along with it. I'm glad I did it. I'm also glad that I'm not in that position of having to hire all the shows in Chicago anymore. Now I can just hire when people contact me to do, you know, just individual things. Like I just got called 2 days ago to put a 10-piece orchestra together for the Temptations in August. We're going to do that at Millennium Park, and it'll be a blast. Mm. That's just a one-off, as we would call it, you know. But the stress of having sometimes 2, 3, 4 shows running and having to be in charge and touch base with each conductor each week of each show, and then playing lead trumpet on one of those at the same time, it was fatiguing. And it was also a nice supplementary income, and I'm fortunate that I had the help put my kids through college, and I'm really grateful that I had that chance. But I'm also happy to be more of a sideman now than I was for many years. It feels good to be back to that position.
Right. So, speaking of happy, you have to be so happy to see the curtain slowly lifting, a curtain that had descended, of course, because of the COVID-19 pandemic. And as the performing arts sort of resurrect from the ashes slowly but surely, this makes a big difference for you as well. Can you just say a quick word about what it means to see the world opening up again and for you to once again be able to do the playing that has meant so much to you?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm chomping at the bit to do it, first of all, as is everybody. And I think that because it's been such a long time, hopefully people are going to be clamoring to go see those shows again as soon as they were safely able to do so. It means everything.
Trumpeter Tim Burke returns to his hometown of Racine to perform with the Racine Concert Band this Sunday evening, 7:30, in the Racine Zoo Amphitheater. The Racine Concert Band under the direction of Mark Eichner. Admission is free. It's a wonderful opportunity to hear Tim Burke. He'll be playing 3 different solo works with the Racine Concert Band. My thanks to Tim Burke for being my guest on today's morning show. And by the way, in the podcast version of today's morning show, you can hear more from Tim Burke, the unabridged interview, along with an extra question I asked him about the national tour of Frozen, on which he is about to excitedly embark. Tomorrow on the morning show, Cynthia Fisher, who helped to organize a new group called Patient Rights Advocate, which is a nonprofit designed to help bring about more transparency in the world of healthcare, in particular, more transparency when it comes to the cost of healthcare, so all of us can come to a better understanding of the costs that are involved in the treatments that we receive. Monday on the morning show, you'll hear the interview that I have just recorded with best-selling author Earl Swift, author of a new book called Across the Airless Wilds. This book examines the fascinating story of the lunar rover. That is that amazing contraption that was a part of the last 3 Apollo missions to the moon, Apollo 15, Apollo 16, and Apollo 17. although now we look back and most of us only remember Apollo 11 and maybe Apollo 13 because of the mid-flight accident. But in fact, according to Earl Swift, it was those last three lunar missions in which far more was accomplished. And a big part of that was because of the amazing lunar rover that allowed those astronauts to travel far and wide across the lunar surface. That fascinating story will be part of the morning show.